Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusions. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizbon, and I'm joined today by the CEO of Lightning, Zohar Atkins, the CEO of Realm, Genevieve Kim, and the CEO of Rad Studios, Ann Dudek. Welcome, everybody. The quote we're going to cover today is from, drum roll please, Friedrich Wilhelm Joseph Schelling, from The Ages of the World. And it goes, "Pain is something universal and necessary in all life. The unavoidable transition point to freedom." I understand that first part, not the second. Zohar, would you start us off with your take?
One taught me love, one taught me patience, one taught me pain. So that's Ariana Grande. I think she says it best. Schelling was an esoteric thinker who was influenced, and in addition to being a famous German philosophy professor and idealist in the 19th century, he taught the likes of Marx. He taught the likes of Kierkegaard. He was contemporaries with Hegel. They had a little bit of a dispute. Schelling was influenced by Christian Kabbalah. And the reason why I'm sharing all of that is because Christian Kabbalah and Kabbalah more generally is an attempt to understand the nature of creation and the nature of divine creation. And it's highly speculative. It's also highly aesthetic. So I'll be interested to get, you know, Anne's perspective on this as well. What does it mean to be a creator? And in the sort of classical telling of divine creation, God just says, let there be light, and there's light. But in the more sort of mystical interpretations, there's a catastrophe that is part of creation. God breaks in the process of creating the world. The world breaks in the process of coming into itself. And so this emphasis on pain as the hallway to freedom is not just a psychological point that Schelling is making, but it's a cosmological and theosophical point, theosophy being the attempt to understand the nature of God. And so it's kind of, I wouldn't say heretical, but definitely unconventional to think of God as somehow in pain in the process of creating the world. But obviously might think of childbirth as something that is painful and yet generative. So I'll leave it at that. But I think it points to the fact that pleasure and pain are interlinked, something we've talked about before, and also that freedom is not necessarily freedom from constraint, but rather freedom that is on the other side of constraint. So constraint feels coercive, it feels painful, but also enables discovery. And so, like, if you think about, I mean, there have been many movies on this kind of thing, but like ballet and The Black Swan, there's sort of a way in which something that's highly disciplined and highly disciplinary could be painful, but also might be a certain kenosis, a certain emptying out that only that discipline allows for. And if you have something that's more modern, in which anything goes, then you don't actually achieve that level of mastery and thus that level of freedom. You know, Robert Greene, he wrote the Laws of Power, sort of a best-selling pop book. He also wrote a book recently called Mastery, I believe, or The Laws of Mastery. And the core point that he makes, which I find very compelling and resonant, is that our culture is very anti-mastery. We love to dabble around, and we tell people not to focus, and this idea that you could spend like 40 years trying to refine your craft and choose a master and apprentice after them, it just rarely happens. And maybe that's how I'm relating to the Schelling point, is that to really get good at or exceptional at something requires this sort of painful process. And we actually deny ourselves that when we emphasize the freedom prematurely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes me think of, I think there are still some places where, you know, freedom is on the other side of discipline sort of still exists. I used to work with Italian cabinet makers, and they are typically family-owned businesses, and they are just what Zohar described there. You know, it's a father who's worked kind of in this shop for 50 years and figured out all the tricks, sort of like, you know, those people where they kind of see the world differently because of their mastery. You know, they just have like a very like complex but streamlined view of the world. And then their sons go into it. And I got to say, they do make beautiful, beautiful cabinets. I saw some truly amazing things. But I know it sounds so mundane. And that's kind of the thing that people would scoff at. It's like, oh, what do you do? And it's like, well, my family owns a cabinetry business for three generations, and I've been trained, you know, by my grandfather, my father. Like, that would almost kind of evoke like a, you know, a wry smile from some people. But it really is like just in essence generational mastery over a craft.
Yeah. I think this is a Japanese term for it. It's like shoo something. Google it. Shoo something. Yeah. Right.
This is an educational podcast. Shoo something.
I'm not Nico here. Just gonna like.
That's fair.
Why not?
I love it.
Shuhari. The concept of mastery and learning. I just remember reading that that there was a value in Japan, at least in not modern Japan. I think it's, you know, still in the culture of learning a specific thing and just getting better and better and better at it. Like, you know, on a cultural level, even if you made just like simple, like, if you made bowstrings, you know, that was still looked at as admirable as long as you committed your life to that act. You know, it didn't matter how humble it was the commitment to the craft that was to be admired and respected. Which I think is freaking awesome. I mean, I can kind of relate to that idea of the constraint being placed upon you, the rules in which you are forced to operate in, giving rise to a higher performance. I don't know if I'd call that freedom, but definitely a higher performance. I know when there's a deadline made on films, like, if there wasn't a deadline made, there would be no film made, because then, you know, the director would never finish, and like the vision would go everywhere. But because there's a constraint of time placed, the movie gets made somehow, just out of necessity.
That makes me think, if we go back to the theology, and what's fun about this is you get to sort of playfully imagine God in very personified human and flawed terms, but almost like God having to write the world into being on a deadline and just hitting send, and then being afterwards being like, oh damn it, that typo. And it's like the typo was Hitler, you know, the typo was like every natural catastrophe. It's like, oops, forgot to delete that one.
The typo was Hitler. Let's just write that
the
down.
Platypus is like the 3 a.m. fever dream where it's like, whatever, just put a beak on it.
Yeah. Platypus.
No, I kid. I think the more radical teaching on evil from Schelling isn't that evil is the result of a mistake, but that actually there are no mistakes, that the things that look like mistakes are actually there by design, which is an equal and oppositely difficult pill to swallow. We're sort of damned if we do, damned if we don't. When you try to think about perfection and then the problem of evil, you can deny evil or you can sort of validate it. But if you go with the other approach, the evil is there to actually provide the pain that then allows you the freedom. So you constantly have a world that's bittersweet or sweet bitter, where these apparent defects are actually opportunities for something that you wouldn't get otherwise.
It provides the contrast, no? Like, if you don't have pain, then what's so great about not having pain? You know, but if, like, let's just say difficulty, like, if you didn't have difficulty, what would, how would you know how to quantify a day that didn't have it? You know?
Or the two are just mixed up together. And the more you add to one side of the balance sheet, the more the other side must match it to balance out to zero in some way.
I have a question kind of on that. Is the taking this to the extreme and kind of what you just said, Zohar, I thought of the old Catholic practice of self-flagellation, I think is what it's called.
Yeah.
Like where, you know, you're kind of really increasing the extreme nature of pain. Like, I don't know. Is there a philosophical response to kind of the extreme version of this?
Yeah. I think self-flagellation is broadly understood within a movement that's called asceticism, which is not unique to Catholicism or even to Western religion. It's kind of precedes and postdates monotheism. But it's born of this idea, I would say, of the desire for mastery and excellence and a certain kind of self-control that is wrapped up dialectically in self-surrender. And it's one path to ecstasy and self-transcendence is getting to a point where of almost like disassociation that also weirdly enough is some kind of freedom from ego. So it's one path. Other people take the opposite path, which is a kind of relishing and positive enjoyment of the material world. So like the sort of Baroque delight in the senses would be the exact opposite of asceticism, like really eat the best food and wine. Mm-hmm. Like if you think of the slow food movement or like foodies who travel the world, like, oh, taste these grapes, you know, and they get all into their like $10,000 grapes or whatever. But kind of, I see the ascetic and the sort of hyper hedonist as two sides of the same coin in a way. Mm. They're both seeking a kind of mastery.
It's interesting because I think human nature is such that we do pretty much everything to avoid pain. Like it's like one of those things where it's human nature. Yeah. We try to avoid pain. I mean, we tell our 2-year-old, don't touch the stove. Like we, instead of just letting them learn, you know, it's like, no, don't do that. Or, you know, it's like, don't do that because, you know, then X, Y, and Z, it's like we condition our kids, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, but you know, that's what, you know, if you don't, then, you know, you're just going to be the laughing stock, you know, like some things where we ingrain it though. We ingrain like not feeling pain. And it's interesting that we try to, there's like the protective mama bear, right? Isn't that why, you know, we try to get our kids not to experience certain things, but we know that is it an unavoidable transition point to freedom? In what instances is pain really, you know, the path to freedom? Are there different types of pain that are freedomable? you know, that get you a token to freedom, which, yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get political because, you know, obviously this is a classics and wisdom conversation, not a culture war one. But I think of Heidegger's line where actually Hölderlin's, where the danger is, there grows a saving power also. And Heidegger comments on this line, sort of, when you experience the danger as a danger, you find a saving power in it. And it's hard not to hear that alongside of this sort of millennial trend to focus on feeling safe and safe spaces and don't trigger me and all of this. And it's like, you know, I worry less about the stove because like that actually does burn. And then more these sort of the idea that discourse can hurt, as like, yeah, it should hurt and find your way through that is my own personal approach to it. But I do think that there's a whole genre of thought from the Germans in particular. And then, you know, obviously there's the 20th century history to deal with in light of the 19th century romanticism that really does see negative experience and adversity as deeply moving and positive. And I think Americans tend not to have that attitude at all. We're like super pain averse. And for the romantics, it was like, bring it on. Like, this is an experience. It's exciting. It's dramatic.
No pain, no gain, baby. Lightweight, baby. Sorry.
There's a prescription for that. There's a prescription for everything.
Yeah.
No pain, no gain is actually just in gym culture.
You'll definitely see the embrace of pain.
No pain, no gain is what Anne was talking about. That's just Catholicism transmuted into gym rats.
Sorry, we just have to let that line sit for 1 second. Catholicism transmuted to gym rats. Zohar has some good ones, but that's making my top five list.
Yeah, Zohar is the best one-liners.
Deadlifting is rosaries for tech bros.
Oh my gosh.
Genevieve just laughed so hard she broke the sound barrier.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I actually remember the first time I was introduced to this idea. In the Robert Jordan series, Wheel of Time, which is like an epic fantasy series, there's this one culture of people called the Aiel, and they are taught to embrace and smile in the face of pain. And I think, like Zohar said, they view it as like a shaping mechanism. And when you accept it, and again, like Zohar said, you find your way through it, it's not such a negative or horrific experience, right? It's like you've accepted it. And I remember reading this and I was probably in my early teens and I was fascinated because this philosophy had never kind of come across. I had never come across it before. And this was sort of the first time I was introduced to this concept through a fantasy novel by Robert Jordan. Hmm. So
sounds an awful lot like Sith philosophy, Anne.
Oh, no. Just kidding. Oh, no.
It's a different IP, my bad. Oops.
There's a book that's not so well known that I read in college called Ambiguous Adventure, which I believe is autobiographically inspired. It's about this guy who grows up in a village in Senegal that is being colonized, and he's a prince, he's the son of the king, but he's given up for adoption by the king to go basically be raised by the town sage, who is a master craftsman in the art of, amongst other things, chanting the Quran. And so this child is brought up to recite the Quran flawlessly, because in the sort of the master craftsman's approach to this is that you have to sound as perfect as if God self were reciting it. And so it's a torturous educational process to get him to this point of excellence. And if you're sort of a Westerner looking in on it, maybe you say it's abusive or something like this. And then he grows up and he ends up going to Paris and studying philosophy. And he sort of has this existential crisis of, does he stay in Europe and become an existential philosopher and hang out with all these intellectuals? Or does he go back to his small town and help it as this town is sort of going through this intense transition from being like a local self-contained enclave to being a place that's being overcome by another culture? And he goes back and he basically becomes the town sage, and it's called an ambiguous adventure, but I resonated with it. I think many of us can universalize from that story, this sort of tension between this mastery of the cabinet maker that like feels so precious and like this lineage that if you don't do it, it was going to die out. And then like almost the inevitable force of like technological progress or globalism that just makes it seem so irrelevant and quaint. And the powers of the world are so great that it like threatens to put you out of business or whatever it is. So yeah, I think
AI.
Exactly. But I think in light of this pain point, that the book kind of is a defense of doing the painful thing because it's glorious. And there is like ultimately an ethic of self-sacrifice. There seems to be a point of connection between the king's giving up his son for adoption, which was the first sacrifice, and then the son's own educational process, which was a second form of sacrifice. And then when he grows up, his self-sacrifice in choosing the harder path of being with his people rather than, let's say, escaping to go like have his cocktails and talk to Sartre and whatever.
I feel like I want to circle back to a little less esoteric discussion of not esoteric. We're talking about pain is the if we look here, it's the God, I just don't have the vocabulary to keep up with you guys sometimes. I want to go back to
no big vocab words needed.
Yeah.
All are welcome take your, here.
Just really, take really your, playing take up the gym, Cyrus. Bro. I really don't want to. I want to move away from the conceptual idea of pain and back to like a personal. Daily experience of it. I want to say that like when Schelling says pain is something universal and necessary in all life, I'm thinking like, yeah, of course it's universal. I see that. It's like everywhere. Necessary? Yes. I think it is necessary because if you don't have pain, you don't have context. The unavoidable transition point to freedom. Why, like in mundane terms, not mundane, but like in any of your personal experience, has it been a transition point? Has it been a transformer of yourself to a higher state? Like when has, like, can you agree with this quote personally? Maybe not give, you don't have to give a very personal account, but like, do you agree?
1,000%.
I mean, I can give a really simple example. Yeah. Like, learning to draw is, some people have that skill innately. I don't. And so I had to learn to draw. And I've been learning to draw since I wanted to draw at age whatever, you know? So this is a multi-decade long experience. And it's, you know, there's some mental pain, which is like, I can't represent the things that are in my mind. There's physical pain, which is literally just the strenuous nature of drawing for hours. Like, but the freedom is that I'm gaining that expression, right, in my drawing. I'm gaining the ability to better show. So I think like you can find truth in this in like you said, very, very mundane examples, like learning how to draw.
I have a follow-up question to that. I'm really glad you actually brought that up. In a world where, and I'm not trying to get political, I'm just asking questions. In a world in which you have spent all this time learning how to draw, how does it feel to know that very soon that whole process of learning how to draw can be skipped with the help of AI, and someone can draw what took you years to do in just a couple of seconds? You know,
this is such a great question, and thank you for setting me up to a topic I love talking about. I think that I don't draw. One, I don't draw for other people, and two, I don't draw solely for the ultimate output. And I think when you talk to a lot of people, there's this story I was listening to this morning about Marina Abramović, where her first painting lesson, you know, her teacher paints this painting, then douses it in gasoline and lights it on fire. And his message to her was, these paintings are only the ashes of my art, because the art is him making it. The art is him living it. The art is him conceptualizing it. And the painting is a mere ash heap compared to that creativity. And so I think like when we talk about AI, AI is an awesome tool. Like I love using it. It's a blast. And I encourage everybody who wants to kind of make visuals to dabble in it. But even the truth with AI is that the real art, the real creativity is your conception of the prompt. It's for you to have an idea, an image, and all these things. And that's where the joy is for me. The end result is an ash heap of creativity, but the joy and the freedom is found in kind of the conceptualization and the process of making that real, not simply the end result once you do.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. I think you should start a product line called ashheap.ai.
Yeah. That's what I should have named my studio, Ashheap.
Just make it a sub part of it, you know. But everyone's sharing their fictions that they read at one point. I remember reading a fantasy series called The Inheritance Cycle. Very fantasy. There's elves, and the elves are immortal in the story, and the main character arrives at, you know, forest of the elves or whatever, and they are masters of magic. They can do anything. And he sees them as he's walking through the woods. He sees them fishing or like hand carving a little statue. And he's like, why the hell would you even bother doing this? Can't you just like sing the wood of the trees into shape? Can't you just like coerce the fishes out of the water? And then one of them tells him, well, if you can do anything in the world that you want at the snap of a finger, what fun is there in that? You know, what would you do with all your time? And it's exactly what you said. It's like the joy is in the craft, is in the dedication, is in through the pain, through the monotony and the trial and error.
Yeah.
I think it's...
And I really like the question. I kind of want to hear Genevieve and Zohar's answer of how they have experienced this personally. I like that prompt.
Good prompt engineering, Cyrus.
Guys, my life is a whole bunch of trial and error. I mean, it's just been fucking trial.
Nico alert.
I didn't realize you had a single one. Okay, it's been trial and error after trial and error. And my birth chart is such. Apparently, like, astrologically, like, it's like, oh, yeah, by the way, the, like, shit storms are going to come. And, yeah, so... which one do you want me to pick? And I think actually is that what I've discovered from pain is that I have developed way more compassion for other people. The very first probably sort of ego death kind of experience was when I got divorced at the age of 24, and, you know, it was very, I mean, just very traumatizing in general, the whole relationship. I won't get into it, but, it was really, really challenging. And, I didn't, you know, before I was a little more judgy, you know, about, I was, yeah, I mean, not little, like, I was just like this obnoxious, you know it all 20 something year old. And I was like, yeah, I know the world. Let me judge everybody. And man, I realized, because I don't think a lot, you know, I think when you go through, when you go through domestic abuse and things, most people don't know, right? And I realized, like, I didn't realize what I was, that I was hiding as well. And I think we don't know what other people are suffering through. And I had no idea what other people were suffering through too, until I just, you know, experienced. And then when I came out through it on the other side, it made me a much softer person. And I would say that compassion is actually the gateway, or if not, it is freedom. To have that ability not to be reactive in life, like, you know, fly here, SWAT, well, you know, like reacting to life in such a way, but actually choosing, right? That having choice and agency and how I'm going to respond, not react to someone else. You know, God knows, like, you know, like, instead of flipping off the driver who just cut you off, is like, can you do a peace sign? You know, and that's what I'm not like, and I mean that metaphorically, right? And so I think it's given me a level of compassion and in sense, freedom. So yeah,
beautiful.
I love that. Compassion is a form of freedom.
Absolutely, I love that answer.
I'm such a bad person, Genevieve, that when I was listening to you talk, I was thinking, why can't I have compassion for the fly and swat it away? Why can't I have compassion for the bus driver and also flip him off? Clearly I haven't suffered enough. Don't take away my judgment.
You're just helping him. You're just helping him along his path. You know, you're giving him a little more pain. He clearly needs it.
He's definitely after me because I kill mosquitoes. Okay.
Yes.
I am the first.
Yes. So,
yeah.
100% there with you on that one, Jen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll save spiders.
With, like, mosquitoes for everything. Yeah.
It's hard to put mine into words, but I'll give it a crack. So I feel like for the longest time, and it's still pretty much true, I'm at odds with myself because I want two contradictory things. I mean, who doesn't, right? I want to have the cake of people liking me for reasons I could, you know, spend a long time talking about. But some of it is probably innate. And at the same time, I want to eat my cake of being an independent thinker and being a contrarian and expressing my authentic truth, regardless of what other people think and whether they like it or not. And ultimately, like, what I want the most is the second thing. But I'm a very nice person who's very agreeable and gregarious. And so, like, how do you reconcile the fact that sometimes your will just is opposed to other people's, or your perspective is opposed to other people's. And like a pure sort of like alpha would just be like, I'm going to, let's say, run, like I'm going to bulldoze. But I like try to deliver my contrarianism with a smile or something. It's like I'm trying to disarm. And it sometimes weakens the force of what I'm trying to do, which like actually is a disagreement of some kind. So I haven't fully reconciled that one, but I would say that if you had found me a decade ago or 15, 20 years ago, I think I would have been much more of like a people pleaser. And now I've become much more comfortable just not being liked by everyone and like being totally okay and happy standing by what I believe in, even if like it's more polarizing. Desire, let's say, to be liked or to make other people happy isn't going to go away, but the pain that I feel when I let someone down, let's say, by being myself, is just a pain that I accept as the cost of my freedom. And so it's not really painful anymore. But in order to get to this place of freedom, I had to let the pain be pain, if you know what I'm saying. Like, you have to feel the pain in order to heal the pain.
To move through it. Yeah.
Can I read a quote? Khalil Gibran. Love that man. Don't know him personally, but sorry. I met him in a little.
Great guy.
Yeah. Irreverent. Okay. In The Prophet, right? He says, "Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Even as the stone of the fruit must break, that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain." And could you keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. And you would accept the seasons of your heart, even as you have always accepted the seasons that pass over your fields, and you would watch with serenity through the winters of your grief.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
Can we end on that?
Walk us out, Cyrus.
I think we're just going to end on that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Genevieve. So much. Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. And thank you for sharing your stories. And I hope it wasn't too much of a pain to listen to us today. Thank you.
We hope it was the right kind of pain.
The right kind.